So I've been asked to say something today about Sujata. And with my interest in the history of our Bhikkhuni Sangha, the ancient great Bhikkhunis whose stories we find in the verses of the women elders, formerly known as the Psalms of the Sisters, translated even in the 1800s, and more recently by Susan Murcutt in her First Buddhist Women. I had interest in the stories of these ancient bhikkhunis who awakened in the Buddha's lifetime and became his disciples. And I was particularly interested to know that there were legitimate female disciples of the Buddha, because although I didn't grow up Christian, the culture that I was steeped in growing up here in the United States had a lot of Christianity in it, and in that culture I only ever heard about male disciples of Jesus, and except for a kind of an undercurrent that maybe there were some women. And it's interesting that I've learned about that actually through my Buddhist studies, learning about the ancient Buddhist women and then their context and then the practices of other ancient religions, then by accident almost learning something about the great women in Christian traditions long ago, and those who were the part of the early Christian samana tradition. So the Buddha himself, I mentioned just a little while ago that Anagarika Martha here went forth on the Buddha's own great departure day, the day that he went into monastic life. And so he went forth into the context of the Samana tradition in India, which was a kind of a counterculture of those who came out of the kind of norms of society and then went and lived in a variety of ways, and some of them practiced very extreme asceticism. And the Buddha himself then went to study with the great religious leaders and teachers of his time, and practiced what they taught, and came to the epitome of what they taught, and then not finding what he was seeking for in that, which he spoke of as the deathless. Then he went on to practice really very extreme asceticism, which is one of the ways that was popular then in ancient India. People thought that long fasting, serious, extreme fasting, extreme self-mortification might be a way to get through the ego and to realize awakening. The Jains at that time, that was their kind of practice, ultimate practice, is to fast to death. And then the idea was that utter relinquishment that happened in fasting to death, that the soul could be freed then and realize nirvana or nibbana after the time of death. The Buddha's complaint about that was that it was really impossible to find any living people who could testify to that being successful. And so it boiled down to being a matter of faith, which so many other religious traditions also, these kind of ultimate things. What happens to you when you die? How do you find salvation? What really is going to work for you in this path? Also often ends up boiling down to particular rituals, and then that's supposed to mean that something good or okay will happen to you, or maybe even liberation at the time of death. And as long as it's revealed by God, then you're supposed to trust in that, yeah? Or God, or a representative of God. The Buddha himself then came to a time of that type of practice and got super, super skinny, and life energy started ebbing very, very, very low. And this is where we come in the story to two very amazing things. Previously I had only thought about it as one amazing thing. Actually, really up until the time we were chanting a couple of minutes ago. You might have thought my runny nose and tears streaming down my face was due to the smoke from the fire today, but in fact that's not what it was about at all. I was asked to speak about Sujata, and I studied about the bhikkhunis and been inspired by the bhikkhunis. But what of the 10 leading laywomen, disciples of the Buddha? Or by definition, we shouldn't call them laywomen, because if they're agasavikas, or foremost leading disciples of the Buddha, then the Buddha himself in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, his very last, teaching or collection of teachings, mentioned that those who were his disciples by definition didn't only have faith, but they had experience in the teaching themselves, having practiced and awakened to it, and also that they had the ability to share that teaching with others. So these are basically certified, experienced and certified teachers of four categories, male and female, monastic, and I'll say non-monastic, not to be monasticentric, but just because a certified teacher in a field doesn't seem like a lay person to me. They seem like something else. They're a master teacher. And by definition, they should be someone who has had at least a stream enter, and so that is experienced a level of genuine awakening for themselves, to have seen Nibbana, to have opened the Dhamma eye for themselves. So this is no layperson, truly, not in the way it's regularly used, but they're not monastics. So there are 10 of them mentioned, and we're going to be chanting the 13 Arahant Teri Bhikkhunis chant later on. But I'll just mention to you that beautiful chant. If we look at in the Buddhist canon, in the Tipitaka, in the Sutta Pitaka, the collection of the Buddha's discourses, then we find these 13 bhikkhuni disciples of the Buddha, and the things that the Buddha asked us to remember them for, very special things that they were commended for, special qualities and merit, each one of them unique, not like a cookie cutter or like the flags that you see strung around here, where you might have a hard time to tell one from the other because they all look so very similar. Sometimes you see the paintings of the great disciples of the Buddha and they all look like that, but when we look at this text, when we read the words that the Buddha is said to have said about them, both for the bhikkhunis and for the upasakas and upasikas, aga upasika savikas, the foremost leading non-monastic women disciples of the Buddha, there are 10 of them in the text, and Sujata is the very first. So I was just realizing today, in fact, with this dana, this offering on the golden tray here of the requisites to support our monastic life and practice, and then the undertaking of the three refuges, particularly how much we're doing, we're enacting today what was set forth in Buddhism with Sujata's story. Formerly, this part of the story of the Buddha's awakening, sitting there under the Bodhi tree, extremely emaciated and in a very rough condition, near to death from this very extreme self-mortification and fasting as a religious practice, trying to awaken, that hadn't led to his awakening. At this point in the story, then, the thing that I had so touched into previously that I felt was so great was the part about the Buddha's intuition of the middle way. So with the arising of the memory of being a young child sitting under the rose apple tree, mindful of the body, mindful of the breath, entering into deep, peaceful, beautiful meditative absorption in which everything became clear, with that memory, and then according to the story, along the river that was flowing in front of him where he was sitting underneath the tree, then also seeing the lute or sitar, I don't know, seeing the master, maybe we could say guitar player, just for contemporary sake, or harp, something between the two, instructing the student, blang, 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 that it shouldn't be too tight, it shouldn't be too loose. If it's too tight, it will break. If it's too loose, that perfect sound won't come, right? And the Buddha, recognizing what he was doing was too tight and very near to snapping. Yeah, and that what he did earlier in his life and what many other people did in search of happiness was the too loose. And they didn't develop the right balance to really be able to gain or experience what his aim was. So this intuition then arose from there. And so I had very much appreciated this, the intuition of the middle way. It's so deep and it touches everything in life and how we are with our mind and our thoughts, how we are with our speech, you know, the right balance, the right pitch in that with our actions, even the smallest bodily action, even well, how we are with the fly that may be buzzing around our head and in our ear, whatever that may be, yeah? I so appreciated that, and yet today, during the chanting, I've been reflecting on Sujata's story, and then the two amazing and marvelous things about this time in this story rose to my mind. Because when that intuition of the middle way arose, that vision into what would be liberating Dhamma, that correct intuition, gaining the real and true sense of it, something else also arose. Yeah? And that something else that also arose was going to change everything and become the foundation for this old and contemporary form of Buddhism that we are living right now. Yeah? So I've been looking at our friend Sarah here and also the one who is with her, together with her in the womb. So Sujata, daughter of Sanya, lived in a village, and she's often known as Sujata the milkmaid. She had 1,000 cows. That's quite a herd. She wasn't a milkmaid with just one cow or just 10 cows, but according to the story, she had 1,000 cows. So a major, major herd of cows. And she was part of the Uruvela village that was not so far away from where the Buddha was awakened. So Sujata, according to her culture and tradition, when she wished to have a baby, she went out to pray in the forest. So in that time, people went to the forest to pray, and they went to the forest to meditate, and they went to the forest to practice asceticism. Yeah? So not only monastics went into the forest, but lay people did too, to get away and have some calm and clear and peaceful time. And it was the culture then to go beneath one of the great trees. Some people now call them the mother trees, but we could also call them the father trees. And the Buddha called his great disciples also great trees. Yes, here we are sitting in a forest with the tall, silent trees around us. Yeah. So there was the custom then to go and to pray if one wished to have a child. And people believed in the, like, that there were great spirits of the earth associated with the great trees. And a small tree might have a small spirit, but a big tree would have a big spirit. And so they would go then, a woman would go, if she wished to have a child, out to the tree and spend time there with one of these great mother trees. And so she had done that. And then she got pregnant. She got pregnant, and at that time infant mortality was way much higher than today, so it was a really risky business for both mom and child. A lot more women and babies passed away then, so getting pregnant, very, very big deal, and of course it still is, especially when the Dhamma practicing couple have a baby together. I see them, it's such a big thing in their life and practice. So Sujata and her husband then delivered, there was this successful, what is it, successful delivery of a beautiful baby named Yasa. Yes? And so then their child was born, and a little while after the child was born, according to this ancient custom, then Sujata then prepared to go back to that very tree and make an offering of gratitude in that very same place, according to the story, to the spirit of the tree. So she prepared to do that. And why we know she had 1,000 cows is because she took the milk from 1,000 cows and then she fed that milk to the 500 and then took that and fed to the 250, etc., etc., down to 8 cows. This was an ancient Indian custom that people thought was going to assure really wonderful and excellent things. So this is like the most refined food imaginable at that time. So then that milk then was used to make milk rice porridge to offer. Mm. And her family had a bowl made of pure gold. Now I'm looking at the golden tray here that has the robes on it. This is the nimitta for the offering. And so then this pure golden bowl then of this highly refined natural cow's milk that had been made into this very smooth substance then was what she went out to offer. And there was the Bodhisattva, having had this intuition of the middle way right then. And he had been fasting for so long. And what happens after the intuition of the middle way? A bright young lady appears in front of him with a golden bowl to offer this most highly refined food. Yes? So according to the ascetic vows that he had been observing up to that point, he couldn't take that. I don't know if he could even take food directly from a woman, and he probably couldn't take gold. And I don't think he would have been allowed to take that kind of food. But this has to do with the intuition of the middle way. An intuition of the middle way told him the body needs food and this is the time. This is the situation. So the thing that brought tears to my eyes is thinking both of sitting in the Buddha's seat as the Bodhisattva, as we all are practitioners who are dedicated to increasing wisdom, reducing suffering in our lives, to practice this middle way. And then with that coming very clearly to the forefront of mind, then the support that was needed also appearing right then and there. And to me, this connected in my mind to the deep dedication to really fully live this life taught by the Buddha. And then amazingly, here in California, the friends, the supporters, the aspirants emerging at that time, together with that undertaking, that deep dedication, and offering the food, offering the robes, offering the basic requisites of life. So not only 2,600 years ago sitting underneath the Bodhi tree, but here under this tent surrounded by the Northern California Sierra Nevada foothills forest. Yes? So this is the thing where I saw the connection and realized, oh, what happened with the Buddha's intuition of the middle way? And then Sujata then appearing. Now Sujata made a request when she came before him. Yeah? And she said she made a dedication, as some of you might have made a dedication when you were holding the tray. She said, I was successful in my wish, in my aim. May you, Holy One, also be successful in yours by the power of the merit of my offering. She made that dedication. Yeah? And then she offered that golden bowl. The Buddha ate. He went down to the river to bathe. He put that bowl out into the stream. And he said, if this bowl goes upstream, I'm going to take it as a sign that this intuition of the middle way will be successful. And the bowl went into a little eddy that was going countercurrent, and it went upstream. Yeah. So he then felt sure, according to the story, that well nourished by her food, that he was going to be successful in this intuition. And then went back to sit underneath the Bodhi tree and experienced awakening. Now, it's supposed to have been that Sujata also is the very first one who is supposed to have, together with her close friend Puna, had the chance to anumodana, the Buddha's awakening. Mm-hmm. That is, to rejoice and to celebrate in it. Mm-hmm. Yes? So she's considered by the Thai tradition, at least part of it, as the Buddha's very first disciple. Mm-hmm. And indeed, in the canon, she's mentioned as being the very first one to undertake the three refuges, not as a monastic, but as a lay person. So the first such disciple of the Buddha. So this making offering in conjunction with people's deep dedication in support of that, the sharing of merit, anumodana, in this kind of way that are so, you know, part of the is it an existential framework? The framework of our gathering together and what we're doing today appears in this very story. So this is what was so deeply touching to me, because I feel that all of us in a way are like the Bodhisattva, and all of us in a way here today are also like Sujata, with that beautiful heart of dedication. And when these two things connect together, I feel in the paradigm of Buddhism, in this middle way, the connection of those two things together is where, really where the awakening happens, and where awakened beings can then not only just pass away at that time, not just part of the dying process, but live and share the Dhamma with the world. Now, as it's been passed down through 2,600 years to us here today.
Thank you.